Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a special horror edition, and fortunately this time I have a whole series to talk about. I mean, there were series in the past that just, I don't know, didn't get it together. This year, it's the 90s horror series on the Criterion Channel. So who better to talk about the series than the programmer of the series? That is Clyde Folley. Hello, Clyde. Welcome to the Madhouse.
Hi, Nick. Thank you for having me.
This is also your first time on the podcast, which is kind of crazy to me.
It is my first time on the podcast. I don't often get asked to do these things. I mean, I remember you invited me to contribute to the screen slate, end of your best list. And I think the first thing I said to you was, no one's ever asked me for this. So it's always a new experience, and you keep shepherding me into these new worlds, and I thank you.
It's crazy that as it happens, so we'll make the most of it. Also, I mean, at the top, I just want to mention, because last time you were curating stuff at the Criterion Channel, you had an WNYC appearance, so I just wanted to plug at the top that you'll also be doing another one of those for this series, which, hats off.
Thank you.
But yeah, let's get into the program, which is available now. It's, you know, you can stream it now. And I just really loved the selection. I was just saying before we came on, I sat down to watch one and I was like, okay, I'll just do another one. You know, and so before I know, I've got through four of them. And I mean, I think a big part of that is just that is the variety of it. So maybe we can talk a bit about that. Like, what did you most want to capture about horror from that decade?
It was sort of tricky to figure that one out for this series. I feel like when I was doing 80s horror, I was basically asked, like, what is the dream list for this series? And I handed in a list of like 60 titles that I came up within one night. I was like, oh, this is the easiest thing in the world. Coming around to 90s horror, I was like, wait a minute, why is this harder to put together? What's going on here? And I was trying to figure out what happened here. What happened is this. Basically, in the late 80s, theatrical distribution for these sorts of movies started collapsing. Theatrical distribution in general started taking a hit. And I was trying to figure out what's going on here. I found this New York Times article from about 1990 that said that theatrical movie going peaked in about 83. And then it started going downhill. And around like the late 80s, a lot of companies started going out of business that were successful in the 80s. Vestron had a huge hit with Dirty Dancing. Gone by the early 90s. And a lot of this stuff started going straight to video. Actually, I think Silence of the Lambs is really important for like trying to figure out what's going on in this decade in terms of horror and theatrical movie going, because it's a horror movie, right? But it's also sweeping the Oscars, and its distributor Orion is out of business by the time the Oscars happen. They're just completely bankrupt. And this is all a very long-winded way of saying that the early 90s were like a period of transition for horror. And to me, this became about figuring out, okay, what are the movies that I like from this era that managed to transcend the limitations, the collapsing industry?
Right.
And are the ones that really stand the test of time. And I think I sussed through this and I figured it out, and that's what this series is to me.
Yeah, that does come through, because, I mean, yeah, we just talked a bit about before we started recording that I don't know if I should start with this title, but a title like The Rapture, you know, or the Abel Ferrara movie you have in here, also The Addiction. I mean, those are movies that really are tapping into the independent, making do with what you can. I mean, I guess Michael Tolkien was like a best-selling novelist, but the means of that movie, they're not extravagant, you know, especially considering the scope of what it's getting into. And that's something I guess horror is always good at. Often it's been like a good movie type of movie to release just because it costs a little less to make sometimes, but you achieve a huge effect.
Exactly. And I think that's why the 80s were such a good period for horror movies, because as you said, they didn't cost much to make. You're not competing with like a Hollywood action movies where you need like the large scale. Like, you can do this for very small amounts of money. And that's why the independents could always do good work with horror. And I think The Rapture and The Addiction are very interesting movies.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we just like dive in the deep end with The Rapture.
If you want it, whatever. This is dealer's choice here.
Well, let's do it, because I mean, it's in a way, it's a movie that people might not expect. And it's part of what I loved about your including it, because it was also like a big deal at the time.
Well, Roger Ebert was a big champion of this film, as I recall.
Yeah.
I mean, because this was a small movie and it was very divisive. And even I was unsure about including it, actually, because I was, it's the question that I asked myself, like, is this a horror movie? And I think at the end of the day, it is a horror movie, but it's a horror movie where in lieu of the supernatural, or maybe it is the supernatural, we're talking about the existence of God and we're talking about the end of the world. So I think it's basically, it takes like the mode of horror and it applies it to these very large themes.
Yeah. And it also, it's funny because it starts off a little bit like it's on the titillating spectrum of...
Yes, it's a strange opening, right? Because it's about Mimi Rogers plays like a telephone operator who has this sort of like miserable existence and just spends her like her night like cruising for casual sex with her friend partner. And along the way, she has like a foursome with David Duchovny. And then and then they end up on the path to trying to find religion.
Yeah. It's a strange beginning. I mean, also just an aside about David Duchovny, like as any like cable surfing kid of like the late 80s also know, he was the guy who hosted Red Shoe Diaries.
Oh, that's right.
This absolutely trashy, you know, like erotica series on HBO, I guess, or something, I think. Or maybe it was Skinamax. I can't even remember. I think that was before this, right? That's probably part of why they chose him for this.
You know, I forgot about his role in the Red Shoe Diaries. And as like a Professor Alman King head, this is really a moment of embarrassment that I really do not have this information in the holster. But suffice it to say, this is a pre-X-Files David Duchovny with a mullet in the first act, who spends most of the first act shirtless. we're talking about this movie, and anyone who's listening must be thinking, how is this a horror movie? What's going on here? And for the first act, I mean, it really is just sort of this weird movie just about like being aimless and trying to find like some sort of like reason to live.
Yeah.
And sort of concurrent to all of Mimi Rogers' casual sex in this film are these people who are having basically dreams of the rapture or the apocalypse. And Mimi Rogers finds herself very intrigued by this and wants to have this dream too, but seems to just wants to have some sort of sense of purpose in life. And then she finds it and she has this dream, but then she starts encountering different challenges in life. I guess I don't know how much to talk about the plot of The Rapture before we start going to spoilers here, but suffice it to say, basically tragedy befalls Mimi Rogers and it leads her to question what she believes in and question God's plan before she starts taking drastic action. And then she becomes a person who wants the rapture to happen, needs the rapture to happen, needs this thing to create the sense of purpose in her life.
No, and that's part of thinking about how or why it's a horror, why it feels so horrific, is just the kind of bottomless doubt, self-doubt that she's going through on just such a fundamental existential or spiritual level. You know, it's more than you expect. And yeah, there are things in this movie, again, I won't say what, that I was surprised to see. There are a couple of things in this movie where I don't think you could actually make a movie now that would have it. I think maybe, you know, one of them where I just don't think they would get money to make it.
This is the movie that it goes all the way.
Yeah.
At any point you start doubting, like if this movie is going to go all the way, don't doubt it goes all the way.
Yeah, it really does.
Mimi Rogers is fantastic in this movie.
Yeah.
She's an actor who I've always been aware of, but I always sort of had a hard time placing or just not knowing why I know who she is, but she's really good in this movie.
She is, yeah. I mean, I almost hesitate to mention it because I don't want to like rehash old like pop culture landscape, but I think like partly at the time she was still overshadowed by like tabloid stuff, basically.
Oh yes, that's correct.
You know, in that she was, you know, married to Tom Cruise, which also puts an interesting spin on the whole religious indoctrination.
Wow, I didn't even consider that.
I have no idea. I won't even name any names. But yeah, she is really great because she goes from being like this totally cynical, embittered person and just goes in the total other direction. I mean, it's crazy how in a way the plot, it probably mirrors the plot of, I would guess, of some like, you know, someone is like her, is like, oh, this promiscuous person. And then they find God, except it's not like, it doesn't get happier from there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, this is not the solution.
Yeah.
It's about someone searching for a solution and maybe this isn't it.
And it's also, it's the 90s, but it's also right at the beginning. It's like 91. Watching it, like I was almost surprised to see some of the stuff it was dealing with. I mean, the evangelical stuff, but also generally, I don't know about you, but It was a bit like when Cronenberg and Peter Chusitsky get together.
Oh, yeah.
It had that kind of like very tense, quiet. It has an amazing opening. A lot of these movies that you picked, they have like amazing openings. Like this one, do you remember it opens in the call center?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also think it's worth shouting out that the DP of this film is Boyan Bazeli, who I don't know if he's best known for these things, but I best know him for his Abel Ferrara collaborations.
Mm.
He shot King of New York. He shot Body Snatchers, which will pop up in this series in a month's time. But he's a very good cinematographer who's still working. He shot Underwater. Do you remember this movie Underwater from 2020 with Kristen Stewart?
Oh, I did. I watched that at the Regal Essex.
Yeah, I think it was a very underrated movie. I saw that thing opening weekend. I was like, why aren't more people watching this thing? It looks great. He's still got it.
Yeah.
I guess he's secretly one of the MVPs of the series between Body Snatchers and The Rapture.
Yeah, no, and you're totally right to bring in like Abel Ferrara more than like, say, Cronenberg, but like, because Ferrara, who we also have here in The Addiction, but just one other thing I want to mention about Michael Tolkien, the director of The Rapture and the writer, is that, of course, he wrote The Player, which then I guess like the next year or two was adapted by Altman for movies. So that's just kind of amazing to think that this one guy is doing those two things.
And he wrote Gleaming the Cube, right?
Oh, right.
This is a guy with range.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So yeah, that's The Rapture from 1991. And yeah, since we're talking Abel Ferrara, another one that's available now is The Addiction.
It's easy to forget that he has not one, but multiple great horror movies. And I think that The Addiction is terrific. It's one of these movies that I was really like, I flagged this thing as essential when I was putting the series together. It's like, we have to get The Addiction. Doesn't matter how it needs to be in there. I don't know. It's cool. It's so uniquely him, but it's also like such like a good film, like of the era.
Mm-hmm.
I rewatched it recently and forgot that like Russell Simmons is a producer on this thing.
God.
The first music cue is Cypress Hills. I Want to Get High. Looks great. It's got this wonderful evocative black and white photography. I think Lily Taylor is great in it.
Oh yeah.
I love this movie. Also forgot until about yesterday when I was looking at this movie again that it was associate produced by Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Oh wow.
Pretty wild.
I had no idea. There's like this weird state overlap of that because like didn't Steve Bannon like produce, worked at Wellspring or owned Wellspring or something like that?
Oh, yeah. But I mean, Silvio Berlusconi, I think, was one of the producers on King of New York.
Oh, man.
So, I don't know, man. I think that perhaps one of the new requirements to hold public office needs to be putting up money for an Abel Ferrara movie.
Yeah. Well, actually, do you want to just like run through a bit of the story for The Addiction?
Sure. The Addiction, it's Lily Taylor is an NYU philosophy grad student who is attacked by a vampire played by Annabelle Sciorra. And then she takes on the tendencies of vampirism herself. But it's, you know, this thing is very much a metaphor for drug addiction. It's simultaneously juggling the vampire movie, but also all the themes of addiction, but also religion, because he is Abel Ferrara is an intensely Catholic filmmaker, and that runs through the entire body of work. So it's a singular movie that I think is very wonderful.
Absolutely. And just part of a pretty amazing run. I mean, if you think about it, like I had to refresh my memory about the exact sequence, but you go from King of New York to Bad Lieutenant to Body Snatchers to Dangerous Game with Madonna to The Addiction. And then, I mean, The Funeral's not my favorite, but yeah.
It's not my favorite either.
Yeah.
But I think that run you just described is great. Also, like Bad Lieutenant was a movie that he made as just like an aside during the post-production of Body Snatchers, if I recall correctly.
Oh, wow. That's like a big movie for me because it's a scary movie. It's like, that's a horror movie in a way. It's like just this idea, I don't know, probably at the time of an authority figure being so completely perverse and falling into like abjection like that, but also just as a character, as a person, the abjection that he goes into, and also like a classic NC-17 film as well, I think.
Oh, definitely. Definitely part of that era for sure. I wish that was a movie my dad told me about, actually, of all things. I remember it's just, My dad always hit me to the weirdest damn movies.
That's great.
And I remember Bad Lieutenant was like, he was just described Bad Lieutenant to me one day. I was like, oh, that's weird. It was one of those movies that was always on cable in like the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah, it's true. And it was on cable. And always for me, it seemed like inevitably the one where he's like naked and weeping is what the scene that's on.
That's always the one. Yes.
Yeah. But now I'm really curious. Are there any other like horror movies that your dad recommended or...
Oh, man. I mean, my dad was the one who told me about Audition.
That's awesome.
He told me about Audition. My dad rented The Entity for me. You seen The Entity?
Yes.
I was like 13 when he rented The Entity for me. And I was like, Dad, this movie, like, this is a bit much, man. He also recommended Straw Dogs to me, but described it as like a more violent Home Alone. Like, I don't know. This is, we're stumbling on some very questionable movie recommending and parenting here.
a proud family tradition of twisted films. I mean, so, but in the 90s, I mean, just thinking about what you were watching, is there anything on this selection that's something you remember pretty vividly from seeing it when it came out?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I remember vividly the trailer for In the Mouth of Madness.
Oh, wow.
Is that the same year as Jurassic Park?
Huh.
I just remember seeing the trailer and being like, wow, this looks cool. And
that sounds right.
Yeah.
Or maybe 1 year after. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, I remember definitely being aware of who Sam Neill was and then seeing this trailer. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Actually, by that same token, I remember being extremely pumped for Event Horizon. I remember being in like Las Vegas on a family trip and seeing like a marquee for Event Horizon, not being able to convince my father to take me to Event Horizon.
Event Horizon was too much.
No, but I caught it on video. It's just my dad didn't want to watch Event Horizon. So like basically the weekend Event Horizon's on video, I'm watching it immediately.
Yeah.
I was probably sixth grade. Yeah, I don't remember. I remember watching Ravenous when it came out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And because I remember at the time just thinking, like, not knowing anything about this movie, I think I caught it on cable shortly after it came out and just like channel surfing and realizing, oh, it's the guy from LA Confidential. And I remember being really taken by the movie back then and then not watching it for a long time after then, being surprised that the movie holds up. Pleasantly surprised, I should say.
Yeah, that's been a while for that one. That one's another. That's also, that's like another
vampire cannibal movie. It's a cannibal movie, but it basically like has like the rules of vampirism in there, and then just also just ends up being like a nightmare about Manifest Destiny.
Mm, yeah,
it's got the Damon Albarn and Michael Nyman soundtrack.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You want to park this thing right in 1999,
and that's also available now in the series. Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump back to a couple of movies that we haven't talked about. Death by Temptation. I mean, that's sort of along a different religious strand or church strand a little bit.
Yeah, I had forgotten that Death by Temptation is also a religious film. So we have multiple horror movies that are about religion in this series. I'm learning new things as we speak. Death by Temptation is a movie I love very much. So this is something that I had not seen until a few years ago. And it's so funny.
Yeah.
But it also like... it's lit like a Mario Bava movie, and it basically all takes place in a 4-block radius in Fort Greene, which is nice for me because that's where I live, and I walk by these locations basically daily.
Oh, wait, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like the bar in Death by Temptation is, you know, the bar Alibi?
Yeah.
It's right next door to Alibi. It's right there.
I didn't recognize that. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's in business anymore, but it's like the location's right there. I saw with the windows open a few months ago and I was like, oh, why are they bringing back the Death by Temptation bar?
They should just open it under that name, basically.
They should. But you know what else I think is worth pointing about Death by Temptation and maybe just the 90s in general is that one of the things I realized when putting the series together is that basically like black people disappeared from horror movies in the 80s, right? There's like a very like rich strain of blaxploitation adjacent horror movies in the 70s. And then the 80s, I don't know what happened. Everything became like very sort of like Friday the 13th, white people slashers. I mean, that's a generalization here. But in the 90s, black people started coming back to horror in front of the camera, behind the camera. And Death by Temptation is one early example of this. Basically, like the entire like cast and crew sort of like came from like Spike Lee's school days. Mm-hmm. The director was a child actor who made only this one film. I think he was like 20 or 21 when he made Death by Temptation.
Oh, wow.
It's shot by Ernest Dickerson, and most of the cast is pulled from School Days. And Dickerson actually is also like another MVP of the series. Between
Definitely.
His work on this and directing Demon Knight, he does some great stuff. And yeah, I really love Death by Temptation. I don't think there's much like it.
Yeah. Kadeem Hardison, you mentioned who's Kadeem Hardison's in it, just like sort of bursting with like charisma.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Kadeem Hardison plays a guy who lives in New York City. He's an aspiring actor, and his friend or cousin, I think friend from his hometown in North Carolina, comes up to visit him. Yeah, and Kadeem Hardison plays a character who sort of like did everything to shed his like North Carolina upbringing and like to be like a New York guy. And there's all this stuff in the movie of Kadeem Hardison sort of like helping his friend, who's played by the writer director James Bond III, to be more like a city guy. But it's all these scenes happen in the movie where it just like takes a pause from being a horror movie about the succubus to just being this like hangout movie.
Yeah,
these guys like hanging out in Kadeem Hardison's apartment, and then like there's like a sequence where James Bond III is just trying on different outfits.
Right, there's a makeover montage, basically.
It's a makeover montage, yeah. It's so funny. So it's just like, it's a good hangout movie. All the scenes in the bar with Bill Nunn just trying to pick up these women using these horrible pickup lines. It's shocking how funny this movie is while also working as a horror movie.
And the bar is kind of the hunting ground for the aforementioned succubus played by Cynthia Bond, mm-hmm. who I guess later wrote like a best-selling novel or
I didn't know this.
Yeah. I was like, what else has she been in? First of all, at the bar, it's just partly, like you said, it's partly comedy as she's just reeling people in and sarcastically like playing to their fantasy while these men are oblivious about that she's doing that, or that she's, yeah, they're going to die. But it's great to see her just kind of play with people like that.
The movie is so visually inventive.
Yeah.
In addition, you know, having these like Mario Bava colors, but it just has, there's the one sex scene where it's cutting back and forth between, you see some guy playing the saxophone, and like the smoky disc. And then at one point, there's a zoom out and you realize that the guy is playing saxophone in the bedroom where the sex is happening. I've never seen this shot before. This is some new visual language that's being written here.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. So it was kind of interesting the way it converges at the end, but not exactly how you might expect it. Also bears mentioning Samuel Jackson is in it.
Yes. Samuel Jackson is in it.
Yeah, in this kind of vision / flashback, right? But it feels like a vision.
I think they can be both.
Yeah.
It plays as flashback, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's a minister, so kind of fire and brimstone minister.
Maybe it bears mentioning here that, I don't even know this, that like my first job in New York City, my first real job was working for Troma.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And showing this movie ends up being like this like weird like bridge between these like two different periods of my life. No, but when you mentioned Samuel Jackson, like the first thought that I had was, I remember like the Troma DVD of Death by Temptation basically just like has Samuel Jackson's face on it, which is very confusing to anyone who watches the movie because he's in the movie for approximately 3 minutes.
Right. The proud tradition of whatever works.
You know, just whatever, yeah.
Put him on the cover.
We got a way to move these DVDs. How do we do that? Samuel Jackson.
What were they making there when you were there?
I was there between movies. I was there basically. Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead,
yes.
Was the most recent movie. And it was still a few years before they made the Return to Newcomb High movies.
Oh, wow. I remember those on the shelf, the Newcomb High movies.
Oh, yeah. They're everywhere.
So that's Death by Temptation. While we're in 1990, mm-hmm. I thought it could be fun to talk a bit about The Exorcist 3.
Yes.
Since there is, you know, I guess a whole new repackaged batch of sequels coming up. But I mean, this for me was like, here's like pure uncut Exorcist because it's directed by the writer.
This is the second movie in the series that's directed by an author turned filmmaker, which ends up being its own little like nutty little strain of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's your knowledge of the William Peter Blatty filmography? Like, he just has like Ninth Configuration before this one, right?
As far as I know, yeah. I don't know.
Which I like. I like Ninth Configuration.
No, it's
very
cool,
much.
Yeah.
But it's just like, Exorcist 3 is an odd movie.
Yeah.
And I would go so far to say that it's a deeply flawed movie.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the flaws make it interesting. it's a very strange movie because it's so much of it are just these long talking scenes, but then it has, I think, two of the most memorable jump scares like of the entire decade.
Yeah.
It's a strange movie. A lot of times I don't even know what to do with this movie. And also it has like a famously very troubled production history. I guess we need to describe what Exorcist 3 is before we launch into this thing, right? Exorcist 3 stars George C. Scott as the detective character from the first Exorcist. Is it Lee J. Cobb?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's that character from The Exorcist who's investigating the string of grisly murders that's happening in Georgetown that bear resemblance to the Gemini Killer, which is this fictional killer in the world of the movie that hadn't killed in decades. But suddenly these murders are happening again. And George C. Scott's character connects it to this mental hospital in Georgetown where they are holding a very strange figure who's played simultaneously by Brad Dourif and Jason Miller from the first Exorcist. And I don't even know how to start explaining this without spoiling some of the movie here, but suffice it to say how it connects to the first Exorcist is unexpected, and it's more than part like police procedural, but then it has these Exorcist elements thrown into it. And I think it's a very baffling movie for a lot of people at the time, and probably still. And basically the troubled production history around this movie arose when the studio realized that they made an Exorcist movie that didn't have any exorcisms in it.
I love that.
And so they basically forced these reshoots of this like final act to like shoehorn an exorcism into the movie. But then they also basically like the reshoots also involved putting Jason Miller in the movie.
Yeah.
To hide this performance that was entirely a Brad Dourif performance. And so then the final product, it's going back and forth between Brad Dourif and Jason Miller, which is confusing and strange, but it's not without its pleasures. And speaking of MVPs of the series, I think Brad Dourif does end up being another MVP of the series.
Yes.
This and Body Parts and other films that I tried to get for the series but couldn't. Brad Dourif is such a great actor. And I think the sort of narrative at the time was, isn't it sad that this actor who won the Oscar from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest has to be in these crummy horror movies? And when the fact of the matter is they're not all crummy, and B, he's really good at doing the specific thing that other people can't really bring, that Brad Dourif level of intensity, or that specific kind of intensity that he brings, as these eyeballs that look like they're about to bulge out of his skull.
Yeah.
I think he's so great.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure on some level I had like was not paying attention to him. But then yeah, he cropped up when I watched Ragtime.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's in Ragtime.
Yeah, sometime last year, and I was like, oh wow, like what, you know, I should watch more of his. And but then yeah, it was with this series more recently, yeah, just seeing him fully commit to these differently extreme characters is really something. And I mean, there are a couple like to camera monologues he gives in this film which are just like actually unnerving. You kind of feel like he like burst a blood vessel doing them from his cell. So yeah, he's something to watch. And the weird thing that's going on with his character and the character that Jason Miller plays, it's so strange. I won't even try to explain it because it's kind of better just to go in if you haven't seen it and just let it happen to you, because that's the way it does happen in the movie. But for me, it's like that's, although it was, I guess, production related or whatever, it's part of the strain of like eccentricity that's in this movie.
Yes.
You know, these sort of ideas, not that that necessarily was only his idea, although maybe that was his like solution for how to make that work. But Blatty, just the sort of things that like, if he was not directing, they'd be like, yeah, maybe not that, but this. But in this case, it's like, oh, is that, you know, like, and especially just weird speeches that also, yeah, will be just cut to ribbons. Like, there's that one like really like intense dialogue between George C. Scott and his reverend buddy who's fallen ill, where he starts talking about how he hasn't been home for several days. And the reason is because his wife is keeping this carp. Do you remember that?
Oh God, I do remember that.
In a bathtub. And you're like, whoa, that's a really weird bit of dialogue. And that's the point. Like the whole speech, it goes on and on. And George C. Scott seems to be kind of relishing delivering this thing that has like no other purpose than to explain why he hasn't taken a bath in a couple of days. It's
I know. I mean, the movie's full of these moments where it's just like, wow, this movie is stopping like dead in its tracks for these digressions. And I guess that is one of the pleasures of this movie, is that it's just like, the thing is so odd and weirdly paced. I think like I'm very turned off by movies that are very clearly referencing all these other things. And I'm much more interested in movies that seem like they're made by someone who's never seen a movie before, where it's just like, that's not how you do this sequence, or that seems odd. But I feel like Exorcist 3 is full of that. It's like, oh, this doesn't seem right, but I'm fascinated.
Yeah. I mean, it has the burden of being an Exorcist sequel. So people expect it maybe to be, I don't know, more cleaner or more coherent in some way, but instead it goes in the other direction of just kind of going inward in weird ways and then exploding outward again. Although I have to say, when I rewatched The Exorcist, I don't know, sometime in the past year, there were things in it in the beginning that I'd kind of forgotten about. So a lot of times the things you associate with a movie aren't like The Exorcist 1. I mean, there's this whole thing where he's setting the scene in New York falling apart, or where Ellen Burstyn, she's shooting a movie that appears to be about like student protests.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Which I did not remember at all, but it's such an interesting way to begin. It sets the movie in like the early 70s. It's not the 60s. Like, they're making movies about the 60s. That's where they're at that point. So by the time of Exorcist 3, like everything is out the window. Like George C. Scott, he's kind of at the end of his rope there. So it's just kind of funny to see what it's doing with The Exorcist, what you might expect. Well, I mean, one other film from the series that we have a little segue here just because of Brad Dourif is Body Parts, which Eric Red directed, because he's in it. He plays sort of a supporting character. He plays a character in this, I guess we could call it, transplant brotherhood.
Yes, that's a way to describe it. I mean, I guess we need to explain what Body Parts is about to explain Brad Dourif's role in it, right?
Yeah.
Jeff Fahey is a family man and psychologist who gets into this horrible car accident and loses his arm, but then undergoes this experimental surgery and gets someone else's arm, but then realizes that, wait a minute, something's deeply horrible here, because he keeps having these horrible visions and his arm starts doing things that he doesn't want it to do. And over the course of the film, he realizes that a few other people also had limbs attached from the same donor, who, I guess we need spoiler alert here, was a psychopath. And Brad Dourif plays this painter who also got one of this guy's arms, and who went from like painting these like Cape Cod pastorals to basically becoming like Francis Bacon.
That's right.
And Brad Dourif, he's in at most, what, three scenes of this movie? But this guy steals every scene he's in. He can steal a scene while out of focus in the background of a shot.
Yeah.
Because you see what he's doing. He's doing something interesting. But yeah, he's in it. He's good. I like Body Parts a lot. This is a movie that I had not seen prior to researching the series. And I want to say this is one of my favorite discoveries during that time.
Hmm.
There's a very precise control of tone, and it's a very like classical horror movie, right? Like, it's not like Death by Temptation, where it looks great but also has these like really funny asides. It's just like, no, this is like very controlled and a classical horror movie, and it has not one but two like incredible like car sequences.
Oh yeah,
just come out of nowhere. And I like the films of Eric Red, this, Conan Tate, the movies he wrote like Near Dark and The Hitcher. Very nice body of work there.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, the car horror is like a particular attraction of this. I remember, I mean, you were mentioning like a couple movies you remember seeing the trailers for. This was definitely like a trailer movie for me, like growing up. I remember seeing it. I don't think I ever actually did, because I was actually sort of frightened by the trailer, like frightened me so much that I didn't actually want to see the movie at that age.
I remember the box vividly. This was the box that I looked at many times at the video store, but never rented for whatever reason.
Yeah. It's classical, and it's also like, it's almost such a like exploitation kind of premise, you know, just the kind of like visceral imagination of this. You have like the killer and then people getting his arms, and like, I don't know, there's just such a, like an awesome like simplicity to that. It's just like,
yeah, no, truly. You know, one of the things when I was popping on this movie for the first time, I had one question going into this movie.
Uh-huh.
And the question that I had was, will this movie explain to me why people consider Jeff Fahey to be a viable leading man in this time period? Because I knew he was in stuff, like he's in Lawnmower Man.
Mm-hmm.
He's they put him in other movies. I just like never really understood why people were putting Jeff Fahey in movies. But he acquits himself very well in Body Parts. But I think the only sort of answer that I got, other than he does good work here, but he has very striking blue eyes. Like, right. I don't know if you remember this detail in Body Parts.
It's true.
But like those eyes really carry a great deal of these scenes. And that's a movie star quality.
It's true. And just also the fear that flashes in them, and then the way that turns into like aggression as his arm kind of takes over. He's good in it. And it's kind of all about that losing control. Like, what if your id took over and all of that? I mean, I mentioned like the kind of transplant brother he has with Brad Dourif's character. And then the third actor, I don't know who it is, who is also another guy. And I don't know if it's a spoiler, but I just want to mention, because it's such a, I just love this scene, that the idea of writing this scene when they go out for a beer together.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. They're just hanging out. I was like, these guys were screaming at each other. Yeah. And like all the previous scenes, Brad Dourif like threw Jeff Fahey out of his loft.
Yeah.
And then they're just hanging out and getting a beer together.
I thought that was such genius, having a scene where they're getting a beer together. Because it's not, in a way, it's not a horror movie scene. It's a scene that comes from writing from the characters. Like, what would they do? Well, I guess they would kind of get together and talk about what it's like all to come from, you know. So I kind of love that. But yeah, like you said, like a classical, it's just like a well-constructed movie. I mean, one of the classic chase sequences.
This is one of those things where there is a moment in the movie that when it happened, I literally screamed in my apartment when I realized what we were about to get. It was so exciting and unexpected. Yes. It's really one of my favorite moments, probably in this whole series. It's worth the price of admission.
It really is. And it kind of takes to another level the premise of the movie. It's mm-hmm. you know, of being stuck.
Yeah.
So, that's 91. And then one other that's I thought might be a fun way to end, just because the kind of way it calls back to like an earlier era, an earlier horror decade, and that's When a Stranger Calls Back from 93. And do I get this right that this was a TV movie or no?
It was a TV movie. Yeah, it aired on Showtime.
Oh, wow.
I think this is one of the things that started happening around this era as theatrical distribution collapsed for a lot of these movies, is that more stuff started popping up on TV, or like the cable TV in particular became more of like a player. And I think Tales from the Crypt was a factor in this, in that it was a very popular cable horror anthology show in the early 90s, but also it was produced by Universal.
Oh, wow.
They just started producing more cable horror movies at this time, and Universal produced When a Stranger Calls Back. They also produced a Toby Hooper movie from this period called I'm Dangerous Tonight, where Madchen Amick gets a haunted dress.
Oh, wow.
Universal is also responsible for producing another cable movie, Frank Darabont's Buried Alive, starring Jennifer Jason Leigh, which is also really good.
Oh, I haven't seen that. Wow.
Yeah, check it out. But it's just that, like, this is one of the shifts of the era, is that things start popping up on these made-for-cable TV movies that are interesting. And I think When a Stranger Calls Back is really special. I feel like in many ways, this was sort of like the impetus for the series. Whereas it was one of my favorite discoveries of that first year of the pandemic, like when we were all just like locked up at home. And someone had recommended When a Stranger Calls Back. And I truly think that like the Babysitter in Peril movie is like one of like the lowest forms of horror movie imaginable. It's like there's so many bad ones. I mean, Halloween excluded, right? But it's just like, you know, you get a lot of bad movies in this mold, and I did not have particularly high expectations, and I popped it on. And I just remember in like the first 20 minutes of this movie, I found myself asking, am I watching a masterpiece here? This is incredible. That first act is so controlled and so scary. And then the movie shifts, much like the first When a Stranger Calls from the late 70s. You know, these are sort of like bifurcated movies where the first act is about a babysitter being terrorized, and then it becomes something different. And in When a Stranger Calls Back, Carol Kane, who was the first babysitter terrorizing the original film, comes back as like an almost like Sarah Connor in Terminator 2 sort of figure, as like a woman who was terrorized and then she survived the experience and then sort of dedicated her life to never being in that position again, and like trying to protect other women from being in that position.
Yeah.
Charles Durning comes back from the first one as the detective helping out. It's really cool. I don't know. It's one of my favorite movies in the series.
Yeah. It starts out and you think you know where it's going to go, because it looks exactly like one of these babysitter and in peril movies. And I wasn't really familiar with this actress, Jill Sholin.
Yeah, I wasn't really familiar with her either.
Yeah. It's funny because she's sort of a bit of a blank slate, but then like settle as the movie goes on, because it covers more than just, I mean, if you really just thought it was what the first 20 minutes are, you'd be wondering, how is that a whole movie? There's more to the movie. It like goes through eras.
Yes.
And she, I thought, was pretty good at showing that the growth, or in some ways kind of stifling of that character, dealing with that experience. And Carol Kane,
she's like a counselor for the, right. like the university. This focus is on like helping like women in the student population. And it's got all these sort of like little like details where the character Jill like works in like a women's crisis center.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout the movie, there are just all these details of just like women who are just like in danger have to navigate this world. I remember there's like the moment that really floored me, which is the very like short, like 20 second scene where it just shows Carol Kane leading this like women's self-defense class. Like throwing a guy on the floor and talking about, you have to defend yourself because if you don't believe in violence, then you don't believe in living. I did not expect this to be coming from this like Carol Kane, like babysitter horror movie.
Yeah. She's pretty no nonsense. While at the same time being like this hugely like nurturing, protective character for the babysitter, Julia.
It's like Julia and Jill.
That's interesting. You kind of have this generational thing then in that way, like younger, and then Carol Kane who's been through it. And then like there's like an added chapter on top of all this, which I absolutely won't give away. But suffice to say, I saw that and I thought, I think one strain about this series is that there's something really twisted that happens at the end of the movie. I think,
well, you know, it's not even just the end of this movie. I think this movie is so unsettling, and there are so many unpleasant things throughout this movie, actually. True. I think it's maybe the scariest movie in this whole series, and there's stuff that really sticks with me. How do we talk about the killer in this movie, like, without talking about, like, I don't know, there's one scene that you watch this and it's like, oh, this is the real Joker here.
Right. Yeah, there's some stuff you wouldn't expect, like dialogue that's chilling in a way that I wasn't expecting based upon what came before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a character who is like, you would say, like, worse than your fears, you know, like worse than your nightmares even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this kind of total sense of nihilism. So it's like the movie keeps having these like another trap door. It's like in the beginning, it's like, oh, okay, you know, I've sort of felt this a little bit, but then you see, well, what happens if you were that babysitter and then that trauma is like constraining your life, and then what is that horror like? But then this horror in like the final third of the movie is just a whole other one entirely again. It's pretty incredible.
I think there's a line that Charles Durning has in the movie, because at one point it's considered that, you know, they were wondering, like, is it two guys? Like, who's doing this? And
right.
And Charles Durning is like, no, I think it's one guy, but I'm terrified if it's one guy, because if it's one guy, he's got something that we can't even begin to process.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Yeah. Charles Durning. Just the cuddly Charles Durning.
What a great screen presence.
Yeah.
There's a moment when I was rewatching this movie last night, actually, where Carol Kane and Charles Durning see each other for the first time in years in the movie. And Carol Kane seems so genuinely happy to see Charles Durning, this jovial presence, this guy that we've seen him in dozens of movies, but she was in like five or six movies with Charles Durning. Like, they have like a real history together.
Uh-huh.
Because they're also, what, they're in like Dog Day Afternoon? Like, they're both in Dog Day Afternoon.
Right.
Are they in Harry and Walter Go to New York?
Yeah.
It's just like this moment of pure joy that when I was rewatching this movie really struck me, because it's such an anomaly in this movie, which is so deeply unpleasant and scary, to see even like 10 seconds of pure joy through me.
Yeah, it's true. Who wouldn't be delighted to see Charles Durning?
Yeah.
It's really sweet to see them there. But I'd seen the 70s film, which again, you absolutely do not need to have seen that.
No, it's basically, there's no,
yeah.
barely any connection is set that Carol Kane, Charles Durning, and that there's a similar structure to the movies. But anyone who's listening to this and is wondering if they should hold off on When a Stranger Calls Back because they haven't seen the first one, just go for it.
That's right. And that one's from 93. And I think I was just going to make sure that we mentioned a couple other titles. I mean, there's Dust Devil. I mean, that's its whole own thing. How did you choose that one?
That was one that I finally got around to watching when I was doing research for this series. I'd seen Hardware before, And I like Hardware fine, but it was when I watched Dust Devil. I was like, no, this is good. This sort of Namibia set desert horror movie. It's just like, when have you seen this movie before? Where Robert John Burke from the Hal Hartley movies plays this sort of like highway demon serial killer.
Yeah.
It's in a way, it's sort of similar to their Red Penned The Hitcher. And that's about like a serial killer on the highway and through the desert, but it's different. As much more sort of supernatural and, I don't know, for lack of a better word, sort of like acid trip sort mm-hmm. of like design to the movie.
Yeah, there is something bad trippy about it. It's sort of assumed it was shot partly in Namibia, maybe not, but just...
I think it's shot all in Namibia. And I think it's part of the reason why... This is another movie that has like a deeply troubled production history.
Oh, really?
It was one of those things where I think that the financiers of this movie, who may have been the people who put up the money for Hardware, and also like Miramax was involved. I don't know if they were involved in the financing, but they're definitely involved in the distribution. But basically Richard Stanley and the crew just like went off to the desert in Africa to make this movie. And the studio people weren't seeing dailies from this thing. So they went ahead, they shot this whole movie and they came back and they're like, wait, what did you just make out there? Like we need to cut this thing down. So yeah, I don't know. That's the freedom afforded when you run off to the desert in Africa to go make a movie, I guess. But then you have to deal with it in post.
Now, this is actually giving me a flashback too, because I wrote about this book about the making of Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I think it's like the same
thing.
Also
Namibia, right?
Yeah, it's the same thing. They went there and they were people basically like, what are they doing out there, you know? So yeah, the place to make your insane movie.
Everyone should be doing this right now. Get your plane tickets. We're going to the desert.
So yeah, I'm going to be finishing that one this weekend, Dust Devil. And we mentioned In the Mouth of Madness. It's always a place in my heart for that. And also, I remember what I want to say about In the Mouth of Madness. Just that, I mean, I guess one thing that kind of, I mean, depending on your perspective, maybe in some ways took the fun out of some horror movies was like the rise of like meta horror or a certain strain of meta horror.
I mean, this is... ends up being a defining feature, I think, of the 90s with horror. And I think it's also something I sort of sidestepped almost entirely when putting this series together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's what I was going to say, which is that instead of having something that's like, you know, Scream or Scream adjacent, you have like In the Mouth of Madness, which is like, you know, infinite, like abyss, kind of like, you know.
Oh, exactly.
So I love that, having that.
When I first saw In the Mouth of Madness, I remember... I don't know. I was young when I first saw it, and I remember actually not being so keen on it for like a few reasons. Namely, just like it felt so different from like the 70s and 80s Carpenter that I had like known and loved. And I remember being especially bummed out that it didn't have a cool like John Carpenter synth soundtrack. It's got like that faux Enter Sandman like opening song.
Right.
Like, it really sounds like Enter Sandman, right? and then. I don't know if it's a matter of like I got older and like my brain melted and became less functional or whatever, but I remember revisiting In the Mouth of Madness 10 years ago and just being like, no, this rocks. This completely rocks. It goes all the way. It is just sort of just like a series of unrelenting, unpleasant horrors, which I also realize is sort of, that's its own specific sort of horror movie, right? Mm-hmm. Like movies like Argento's The Inferno, or like The Beyond, right? Which like the movie that's basically just like a series of very horrific, unpleasant things,
right?
Just like tacked together with like disregard for plot or coherence. And it turns out I really love these kinds of movies. And I think In the Mouth of Madness just falls into this thing where it's just like, yeah, we're gonna put a bunch of really unpleasant, horrific things next to each other, and it's gonna work. And it's like, all right, you got it.
Yeah,
you did it, John Carpenter.
Yeah, it's sort of the like 4-day running fever nightmare based strategy.
Yeah, exactly. you know, it's sort of it becomes this great argument for like maybe plot doesn't actually matter.
No, yeah,
like maybe these aren't the things we remember from these movies. I don't know. Food for thought.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think that's actually maybe a great way to wrap up. Just it's the nightmares. It's about the nightmare friends we made along the way.
Yes, exactly. About how haunted one can get by these horrific images, these ideas, whatever. Like what sticks with you?
Yeah.
And I think that putting together this series, a lot of it was just like, what are the movies that have just stuck with me? Like what's lingered in like the back of my mind for years? Or like, what are the new things that have like popped up and really stuck with me? You know, I by no means try to claim that this is some sort of comprehensive survey of the decade in horror. It isn't. But what it is like, these are the things that I remember. These are the things that stuck with me, that things I find special. And maybe these aren't the best known films, but maybe we should be watching these movies and talking about these movies more. So it's just sort of, what are the movies that are important to me? Perhaps they'll be important to other people as well.
Yeah. Well, I certainly was binging through them, so I'm sure other people will be doing that. So it's on the Criterion Channel. There are even like a couple we didn't mention. I'll let people go and discover those. And then coming up, you have Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, another Ferrara coming up in November as well, Body Snatchers. And then in December, the Paul W.S. Anderson joint Event Horizon, which I guess we mentioned as well. So
we did mention Event Horizon. There's no getting around Event Horizon.
Thank you for walking me through these. Let's do it next for...
Better not be 2000s horror.
That's right.
I need a new bit. Thanks for having me, Nick.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.